So today we're going to focus on the Parshios of Tazria Metzora. And I wanted to just begin by talking about the fact that, you know, there's really a complexity, I think, involved in parenting in today's day and age, which is clear, just in general. And it's always been somewhat of an enigma to me that the most simple things have the most complex instructions with them. My kids have this, they love these chocolate eggs from Israel. The chocolate eggs I'm talking about. You break it open, it has a little toy with this instruction booklet to it. And yet, when it comes to the most complex thing of all, which is parenting, we don't have any instruction guide with us. And so it seems somewhat difficult to understand how that could be. However, I personally believe that Chazal teach us that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, he was Histakel Ba'oraisa Hu Bara Alma. HaKadosh Baruch Hu used the Torah as a blueprint for creating the world. And if that's the case, which is what our tradition teaches us, then really all of the things in our world, everything which is contained in our world, is an emanation, at the very least, of the ideas, the values, and the secrets contained within the Torah. And that would apply to everything under the sun, including parenting. And so, if that's the case, then the logical jump would be that parenting advice, parenting tools, and parenting guides are really inherent within the Torah itself. So that being said, I guess when you look at Tazria Metzora at first glance, it doesn't really jump out as the parsha that would hold any ideas for or strategies for parenting, but the truth of the matter is it really does. Tazria Metzora, as their name suggests, deal with the complicated situations of childbirth and purification, Sara'as, which many people translate as leprosy, but probably was not leprosy, afflicted garments, and the purification process in general. So I wanted to start going through one particular piece, and that is in Perek Yud Dalid, Psukim Lamed Gimel and Lamed Dalid, and then focus on Rashi, and then take it from there. So the pasuk says as follows: Vayidaber Hashem Moshe v'al Aaron lemor. Kadosh Baruch Hu spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, Kisavo el eretz Kenaan, asher ani nosein lachem la'achuza, v'nasati nega tzara'as beveis eretz achuzaschem. Basically what that means is that when you arrive in the land of Canaan, that I will give you as a possession, and I will place a tzara'as affliction on a house in the land of your possession. So Rashi immediately comes in and says as follows, v'nasati nega tzara'as, and I'll place a tzara'as affliction on the house, so besorah hilahem. This is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Why? Shehanegayim ba'im aleihem, because these types of afflictions is how we're going to translate nega as an affliction. These types of afflictions, lefi shehitminu emorim, the Amoraim, the Amorites, hid matmonial shel zahav, they hid golden treasures, bekiros Batehem, in the walls of their houses. Kol arba shana shahayu Yisrael b'midbar, and this happened all 40 years that the Jews were in the desert. Va'ayidei hanega, and as a result of this affliction, noseitz habayis umutzan. That what happens when you see that this affliction is on the walls of the house? Basically, this affliction, this discoloration in the house, is pinpointing exactly where the gold was hidden. So the Jews see the affliction, they see this type of discoloration, they know exactly where the gold was hidden, and they break down the walls and they become wealthy. Okay. So, this Rashi kind of like jumps out at you as being somewhat, I guess, off the beaten path, I would say. We're clearly talking about tzaras, we're talking about afflictions, we're talking about discolorations, we're talking about things that are not positive, and yet Rashi is saying that it really is very positive. In fact, the Lashon again is Besorah Hilahem. This is a very good thing. So the Piyasasna Rebbe, is posthumously, he's my Rebbe. He died, or he was killed in Treblinka in the 40s. During the war, he was originally from the town of Piyasasna, then he was herded into the Warsaw Ghetto. He was famous for writing his Sefer Eish Kodesh and then hiding it in milk containers that were hidden in the Warsaw Ghetto, along with the Oneg Shabbos archives, the Ringelblum Oneg Shabbos archives. And after the war, it was found by a soldier who showed it to a chaplain who read Hebrew and then realized what he was holding. But the Piyasasna Rebbe also, just for you to know, which is always good to know, wrote a bunch of other svarim, but one sefer which he wrote was called Chovas HaTamidim, a student's obligation, which is just an absolutely brilliant piece of literature on his educational philosophy, which was first of all, besides for the fact that it was so far advanced for anybody living in the 20s and 30s when he wrote it, but also just when you read it. It has very strong overtones of John Dewey, of Kant, of Pestizzoli, certain educational figures, and it's really very interesting to see the things that he puts forth. He focuses a lot on individuality and a lot on accentuating the individuality of students. But anyway, so in his Sefer Eish Kodesh, this is the one that was hidden, he asks the following question. Now, if in fact the plague is purely beneficial, which is what Rashi seems to intimate, so then why is the house upon which there is saras tame for 7 days? The following pasuk, the following pasukim, teach us that once the house is afflicted with the affliction, plague, whatever it is, of saras, it becomes tame for 7 days. So the question is, if it's a good thing, because it's pointing out where the gold is hidden and where the treasures are hidden, so then why is it tame for 7 days after that? Not only that, right, but as the Ramban writes, which is quoted by the Divrei Elimelech was the Piyasasna Rebbe's father, he says that this type of tzaras was completely supernatural. So the plague, which really only existed to point out the fact that there was a treasure, so it only exacerbates the question, why would there be a tuma connected to something which is positive? It doesn't seem to make sense. So, the Piyasasna Rebbe says as follows, that it's true that everything which happens to us, even when things are tough, is ultimately for the best. And parenthetically, as we know, the Rebbe of Rebbe Akiva, whose name was Nachum Ish Gamzu, used to say, Gamzu Latova, so often that everything is for the best, so often that they gave him the name Nachum Ish Gamzu. There's clearly a concept like this in our tradition, that Gamzu Latova, whatever it is, sometimes things are so difficult, we certainly can't comprehend or understand, but we certainly have emuna and bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that there is some reason, and ultimately, if God is Kulo Tov, then everything that happens needs to be understood in that way as well. So ultimately, everything happens for the best. However, when things are so dark and dismal, and it doesn't look like there's a light at the end of the tunnel, so it's possible to start to have doubts, such as how could God's intention be good for us? Now you have to remember that the Rebbe was writing this particular piece in April of 1940, when the Nazis had already prohibited the opening of the yeshivas, chadarim, davening with the minyan, no mikvah. There was nothing that was available to the Jews in terms of being able to practice Judaism, certainly not openly, and with the threat of death in private. And so it is easy for a person to become full of doubt in times of uncertainty. However, that is the exact reason why the Torah teaches us that even though the mark on the house was Tamei, and if a person touched it, they would become Tamei, but Hashem still used it for the good of the Jewish people. First, it was Tamei for 7 days, and then Hashem revealed the treasures. That's the way the Piyasasna Rebbe understood it. It's not that they saw it, they got the treasures, and then it was Tamei. But first it needed to be Tamei for 7 days, and then we saw the silver lining, then we saw the treasures. So that, to me, opened up a tremendous piece to parenting that I think is so important. And so the first topic that I want to talk about is helicopter parents and teacup children. What's helicopter parents? What are teacup children? We'll go through. So one of the areas that that educators are seeing more and more of are when parents kind of like hover over their children and catch them before they fall, give them things before they cry, feed them before they're hungry, make sure that they're placed in groups where they may not belong. And so what happens when we create a culture like this? Well, the way educators and psychologists and sociologists understand it is that we create children who become teacups. And the children grow up to be fragile individuals who, when faced with difficult situations, crack under the pressure. Children need to be exposed to the 7 days of Tuma before they're given the treasure. They need to fall. They need to be hungry. They need to cry. They need to fail. Because it's only through these things that we can truly create youth who are resilient to the difficulties that we have today, or that our children certainly face today. Now, what makes it so difficult is that our instinctive nature as parents is to protect and to shield our children. However, what's so interesting when you really think about it is that what we view as shielding very often does the exact opposite, because it exposes our children to situations that they are ill-equipped to handle down the road. And what we view as exposing our children to harm is truly protecting them, because they learn the skills and techniques to be able to compensate later on in life. And that's the first idea that I wanted to focus on. Anybody have any specific questions on that particular piece? Okay. The next idea, and that's really how we'll go through the shiur. We'll take it piece by piece. We'll go through idea, and then I'll get into the parenting piece. Yeah, please, please, please. Yeah.
In terms of exposing their children.
Right.
And then hopefully,
right,
they learn how to cope. Well, the fear is that they don't cope.
Right.
And then you can't pick up the pieces.
Right. So we're not talking about major exposure to significant or harmful situations. We're talking about if a child doesn't make it onto the basketball team, don't call up and pull strings. It's okay for your child not to get onto a basketball team. It's okay for your child not to be placed in the highest class, and to allow them to work hard to get to where they need to be. Because if everything is always given to them, then at the first sight of something that they don't achieve, then they're unable to cope with that. And so nobody wants to see their children be sad or upset about the fact that they're not getting onto a team. Nobody wants to see their children hurt themselves. But it is so important. You know, even in nature, by the way, I was reading a study, which is really interesting, that says that the reason why we have so many more cases of allergies nowadays than we used to is because parents shield their children from dirt. That when we were younger and our parents said, get out of the house until it's dark, and I don't want you back in. So we would play with mud, we would play with dirt, we'd roll around in dirt, roll around in everything that's dirty, come in absolutely filthy, and expose ourselves to germs and all these different types of things. And that really helped to boost our immune system. Whereas nowadays, everything's antibacterial, and everybody's got to be clean. And so our children are not being exposed to those things, and that's really harmful. I mean, it's harmful at the end of the day. But that's what we're talking about. Yeah. No, when we're talking about more intense types of things, obviously parents need to be there for children and to work with them and to work through problems and to help facilitate that. But the truth of the matter is that it's a good idea, I think, also for parents not to necessarily shield, but for parents to work with and to help facilitate the growth through a specific situation. But yeah, I mean, I think we would both agree. Okay. Anything else? The Sfas Emes, the Gera Rebbe, treats us to a beautiful idea found on this pasuk as well. It's actually a really, really very sweet idea, and he says as follows: that just as the body protects the neshama, and the clothing protect the body, so the house protects the person even more. It's like an added protection. So it goes house, clothing, person, neshama. Therefore, one should be looking at the tzaras marks on the house as a further shmira for one's neshama. That Hashem doesn't look to go after the soul of an individual, but rather go step by step, giving people an opportunity to perfect themselves. The first step should always be the most removed, and then closer and closer and closer. Which I thought was a really, really powerful idea that the Sfas was saying. Saying, look, clearly there is a tzaras for a reason. Whatever that reason is. We generally say Lashon Hara has a big part in why tzaras rears its head as an affliction. And so God doesn't like immediately go for the jugular. God says, look, I'm going to give you a little bit of a sign. On your house. Take it for what it is and do something about it. You don't do something about it, your clothing got hit. You don't do something about that, your body gets hit. And then after, you know, once there's no recourse, so then I'm going to have to go in a little bit more. It's going to be a little bit more invasive. I think the relevance that has specifically on child rearing is so important, especially for adolescents. It's essential when children are young, but certainly when children get into this adolescent period, that messages need to be clear. For example, the following thing, XYZ, is unacceptable. Period. But to understand the life of the adolescent is to also understand the fragility of who we're dealing with. So early adolescence, which generally begins around 10 or 11 and goes until about 18, 20, the big range, so is an exceedingly tumultuous time period for children. There are physical changes, there are hormonal changes, philosophical maturation, a lot of social pieces that come into play, creating a sense of individuality. I always like to explain it that you need to imagine from the age of 0 until 10-ish, you're the earth and your child is the moon, and they just come around all the time and they're in orbit and nothing changes. They don't divert their path at all. They copy what you do. They worship you. You're always right. Everything is always good. And then 10, 11, kind of like pull away. And they start to say, you know what, I'm not exactly like my parents. I need to kind of develop my own sense of self. I need to be my own individual. And that's why, by the way, rebellion is not a bad thing. Rebellion is good. Rebellion means that children are pulling away and developing themselves as individuals. Rebellion becomes bad when it becomes unhealthy for the child. But a child who wants to experience different things, assuming that it's within, you know, a normative range, so that's a good thing. That's a good thing. It means that they understand themselves, that they're aware of who they are, and they're aware that they need to change. So anyway, there is that sense of breaking away the individuality piece and emerging as a new person. And these are all happening at once, combined with the academics, combined with the tension and the rigors of just daily life. So there's a lot going on in these really little people. And so when I read the words of the Sfas Emes, I said to myself, of course, just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu deals with us when it comes to punishing us when need be. So that is the same style and approach that we should be employing. There's a difference between joking around with a child and between disciplining a child. And so while we can use the same words, children tend to grasp the difference in the different context quite quickly. So let me tell you what I mean. When we discipline out of frustration, what generally happens, and this might not apply to anybody here, but it does happen often, is that we discipline with character assassination. Meaning, you are rude. You are obnoxious. You are embarrassing. You are annoying. We make it about the child, that the child is annoying. The child is obnoxious. You are defining the child with an adjective, but you are defining them nonetheless. The first approach should always be to label the action as an action that was done, but not to define the child. What you did was obnoxious. What you said was rude. What you did was annoying to me and the people around you. With everything going on in the lives and bodies of adolescents, it's imperative to understand that little changes in the way that we speak, labeling the action as opposed to defining the child, can have a major impact on the way that our children develop and a major impact on the way that they see themselves. Because don't forget, it's an exceedingly sensitive time as well. So they overthink. They're hypersensitive to everything. I don't want to go out, I have a little zit, I don't want to do this. Everything becomes very, very, very sensitive. So once you label them as you're annoying, so now I'm building up myself, and as I'm breaking away from my parents and trying to create my own sense of individuality, so basically my parents are telling me that I'm annoying, so I'm going to build that into my own sense of identity. So now my identity is that I'm an annoying person. Great, that doesn't fare well for a child. That's not a good thing for us to do. And the reason why I started off by saying that there's a difference between joking around with a child and disciplining is because it's okay to joke around. That if children know that we're joking, we can be a little bit more loose. We're not assassinating them as individuals, we're just like joking around. But when it's disciplining and when they see that we're serious, it's so important to make sure that we label the action as opposed to define the child, especially during adolescence. Okay, what's that piece? Anybody have any questions about that? Comments? No? Okay. Next. Okay, Parshas Tazria begins with the laws of ritual purity after childbirth. And Rashi quotes a very interesting statement from an Amora whose name was Rav Simlai. So the parsha of Tazria starts off by Dabar Hashem Moshe Lemor, and Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, Dabar al Bnei Israel, speak to Bnei Israel, Lemor Isha Ki Tazria, when a woman gives birth, and she gives birth to a boy. So we start talking about the days of impurity. But listen to what Rav Simlai says, which is really mind-blowing. He says as follows, Isha Ki Tazria, when a woman conceives, or when a woman gives birth, Asher Rav Amar Rav Simlai. Rav Simlai says, and he was an Amora, Keshem Shitziraso Shel Adam, just as the fashioning of man, the creation of humanity, came Achar Kol Behem Achay V'Of, after all cattle and beasts and fowl, B'masa Bereishis, right? The way the Torah told the story, man was Adam Arishon was created after. So kach toraso v'nisparsha achar toras behem achay va'of. So that's the reason why we're explaining these laws that have to do with humans after we explain the laws that have to deal with cattle, that have to do with the laws of cattle and beasts and fowl. Because don't forget, in Parsha Shmini, we dealt with all the kosher animals, all the non-kosher animals, the tumah, the tara, shratzim, all those different things. So first we're going to deal with animals. Then we're going to deal with humans. Just like God created the world, first animals, then humans. That's how we're going to speak about it. First animals, then humans. But I don't know, for some reason it kind of like rubbed me the wrong way that this is how it was understood, that this is how Rav Simlai understood it. And thankfully, I was not alone in terms of that. And I want to share with you an absolutely gorgeous idea that I saw in a beautiful sefer written by Rabbi Tzvi Meir Silverberg, who is actually alive now. He lives in Yerushalayim. He's actually the grandson of Rav Gedalia Shor. For those of you who know Gedalia Shor, wrote a song called Or Gedaliahu. Anyway, so he says as follows, that the idea of Rav Simlai refers to the two facets of human beings. And he writes specifically dealing with the Jewish people. And that is as follows. The first chelek is the neshama, the Yiddish neshama, which includes all areas of Kedusha, which are inherent in each Jew, and a kedusha that we say is a chelek elokai mimal, that the kedusha that's inherent within us, that each Jew has within them a nitzotz elokus, that a spark of God. We have a chelek elokai mimal, that it's really like real part of God within us. And Chazal teach us that human beings are higher than even the highest angels, higher than even the most heavenly celestial beings. And that's one facet. And there's a second chelik, there's a second part, and that is the physical body. And the goal for each individual in this world is to utilize each facet in the service of God. And he goes on to say that it says in Tehillim, Parakuf Lamed Tes, that speaks about God's omnipotence, being absolute, and that he's always aware of each person's most innermost thoughts. So he says on the Pasuk, Achor v'kedem tzartani v'tashes alai kapecha. Back and front you have restricted me, and you have laid your hands upon me. So he says, Chazal explain that achor means that you've created me after all the creations. And kedem means that if I am meritorious, I will be considered as if I was created first. So what does that really mean? That on a deeper level, each Jew really has two spiritual components. One is Kedem, which is the highest level, and one is Achor, which is the lowest level. That as we know that a Jew is comprised of both of these, and as much as we are able to overcome the difficulties and hurdles in our lives, we can switch the force of Achor. We can switch the more mundane, the more humanistic piece, and make it Kedem, make it holy. Until we get to a point where we can actually say that we came before all creation. So what happens when an individual sees themselves, himself, herself, as only having one dimension? So for those of us who are introspective, it can be very damaging because it exposes many internal conflicts and contradictions that lead to depression, that lead to confusion, spiritual depression, spiritual confusion. But when we understand that we're comprised of both a humanistic piece, a human piece, and a more lofty piece, so it allows us to recalibrate our thoughts, it allows us to recalibrate our feelings, and understand that our goal is to channel the humanistic areas towards God. And by doing so, we create a synthesis between both areas. So we need to view ourselves as people with the qualities of Achor, which are humanistic, and Kedem, which is the loftiness. And it's almost analogous to the idea of Sula Mutzav Arza V'Rosho Magia Shemaima. Understanding that there is a ladder. There's a ladder with one part that very much is embedded in the ground, embedded in the earth, in the tangible. And one part reaches all the way up to the heavens, the loftiness, the spirituality, the holiness. And we have both of those components. Both of those components live within us. And understanding that should imbue within us the utmost level of joy. Because every time we try and work on ourselves and we succeed, so we know what hurdles we've overcome. And every time we try and we fail, we understand the difficulties involved and we understand what the potential pitfalls were. And so the idea that I'm just going to close with is as follows. That the idea that I think really comes out very, very beautifully and very, very clearly is that of character development as it relates to child rearing. But character development and child rearing is essential to do in the right way. And there are two things that I want to focus on. Number one, age appropriateness within child rearing. And number two, understanding what we're capable of. Not only us, but our children. There's a great story that's told about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. You might have heard of it before. And that was that once Rav Yaakov was asked, or invited to come to his student's house for a meal. And the student prepared a lavish meal, his finest silverware is kind of finest china, silver decanters on the table. I mean, just like really, really beautiful. And he had a 2-year-old son. Yaakov came in, sat down, started to eat. And the son stood up on the chair and then jumped up on the table, started like jumping all over the table, kicking things, whatever it was. So the student pulled the child off and reprimanded him. Rav Yaakov did not get involved, but afterwards, Rav Yaakov reprimanded his student. And he said, your child is 2. Your child's not going to be jumping on a table when they're 15. And if they do, you have other issues that you need to worry about. But you need to assume that your child's not going to be doing that. So, yes, you need to take the child off, 100%. But you need to do it in the right way. You need to understand that a child is a child. And it's not out of the realm of crazy for a child to think that, or a 2-year-old certainly, that I can climb on the table. When it comes to character development and character refinement, it's really important to know what areas should be focused on at what ages. Teaching children to say please and thank you is an important thing to start from early on. Telling a 2 or 3-year-old that they need to look at an individual when they speak to them is not necessarily something that should be focused on at that age. And so, look, each person, each family has their own value set, has their own characteristics that they find important and essential that they want to focus on as a family. But there are objectively certain things that are appropriate and age-appropriate for children. And those objective values are, I think, pretty clear. I don't know if I necessarily need to elucidate right now what exactly we're talking about, but that example of what I had said before is a perfect example. When a child is 2 or 3, they're going to act like they're 2 or 3. When a child is 5 or 6, they're going to act like they're 5 or 6. But it's also important to understand that we need to explain to our children that what's cute at 2 or 3 is not necessarily cute at 11 or 12. That there's a difference between being a child and being an adolescent. And so, on the one hand, while we don't necessarily need to discipline every little thing that a little child does, at the same time it's important to impress upon our children that there's an appropriate way of acting when you're older, that even though we didn't discipline it when you were younger, you will be disciplined for it when you're older. And the second point that I wanted to just discuss quickly was that of understanding what we're capable of. When children, and this really goes back to what we had just spoken about in terms of Achor and Kedem, and the Sula Mutzav Arza, Verosha Magia Shemaima, and that is the fact that when children understand that they're human, and understand that as human beings, they will entail struggles, and sometimes they will overcome struggles, and sometimes they won't, and that's okay. That's a really important thing that I find very often. People don't necessarily always remember that when children succeed, so we celebrate that success. But when children attempt to succeed, we don't necessarily celebrate the fact that they made an attempt to try and overcome. And it's really, really important to focus on that. It's important to focus on that in general, and certainly when it comes to character refinement and children learning how to be a mensch, learning how to do the right thing. We need to focus on the good. Focus on those little pockets of, you know, wow, my child just completely surprised me and did something that I've been trying to teach them, but I haven't really seen. Capitalize on that. Call it out. Call it out and call it as what it was. I'm really proud of the fact that you went over and shook Mr. So-and-so's hand on your own and I didn't even tell you. That's amazing. Even if 99% of the time they don't, that 1% that they do, by us capitalizing on that, it calls it out. It makes them feel important. It makes them feel that they can do it. And it brings it into the forefront of their minds. But I think it goes more than that, and that is the fact that we need to support the attempts, not only just celebrate it, but support it. That as parents, our goal is to see when our children are trying and help work with them, help teach them, give them the skills, give them the techniques that are so necessary to succeed and be successful. And I think the last point really is that we cannot rest on our laurels and assume that our children are going to learn appropriateness from osmosis, from the things that are around. It's a really tiring job. Parenting, I don't have to tell you, you all know, parenting is very, very tiring, but that's par for the course. It's not the same. Having a child brought up by hoping that they're going to do the right thing is not the same as walking a child through and on and when we're really, really tired, staying up and working through working through different things with children. When it comes to disciplining, we're exhausted. We let things slide, but when we let things slide, we oftentimes miss really important teaching moments and teaching opportunities. But most importantly, and I think this is really the point that I would want you to leave with from this last piece that we spoke about, is that our children need to appreciate the fact that they're human beings. Appreciating the fact that we're human beings allow us to put things in context. It allows us to understand that sometimes we're going to, I guess, give in to our urges. Sometimes we're going to fail, even if we try not to. And sometimes we're going to succeed, but it's okay. It's all part of learning, and it's all part of growing, and it's all part of the process of maturation. That's a really, really important point. But anyway, those are the three areas that I wanted to focus on today. I think as we go on through the Parshios and as we peruse through Sefer Vayikra and get to Achrimos and Kedoshim and to Emor and Bahar, the topics I think will lend themselves much more overtly to just general parenting topics in general. But I certainly hope that you enjoyed it. I know that I enjoyed putting it together. Does anybody have any specific questions that they wanted to ask before we conclude this specific session? No? Okay. Thank you very much for your time. Oh, you do? A comment. Okay. Okay.
I was very surprised. Actually, when David had his aliyah for his bar mitzvah, mm-hmm. I was very surprised at the number of girls who came up to me. I had no idea who they were and wished me a mazel tov.
That is nice. That is nice. Thank you. That is.
I didn't know who they were.
That is.
And it's hard for 12 or 13 year olds to come up to me and say, Mazel Tov, Mrs. Solomon. I just thought that was really nice. When, I didn't know who they were.
When I came to Moriah, my first day, when I actually came to check out the school before I was even hired. So I came to Davin in the morning, and I must tell you, it was absolutely amazing. Everybody got online to share, not being prompted. Shook my hand. The girls came over to say hello. It was actually very, very nice. I was very, very impressed. But I think we would be surprised that our children tend to act much more appropriately than we give them credit for a lot of time. What did you say?
When we're not around.
Exactly. And that's really the biggest testament of to our good parenting, I think, which is when we get calls from other parents and say, I just want you to know your child is really, really appropriate. It means that we're doing something right, and we have to take comfort in that as well. I mean, we put in a lot of work, and we don't always get patted on the back for it. We never get patted on the back. We're just constantly, in the line of fire. Our children are complaining, which is normal. But it says a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.